You might think that the history of Catholics since 1800 is a parochial matter, interesting to them but not to anyone else. In fact, it raises a universal issue, the rights of conscience against the state and of minorities against majorities. In the words of St. Thomas More on the scaffold, how to be the king's good servant but God's first. Before the Reformation, Catholicism was the religion of everybody in the country, and there was an intimate association between church and state. After that, it was a persecuted minority. During the 16th and 17th centuries, priests worked in England at the risk of their lives, and in the 18th century, they were still liable to life imprisonment. Since 1800, Catholics have had to work out how to become integrated into the society around them without being absorbed by it, and so surrendering the beliefs and principles for which they endured persecution and repression in the first place. Moreover, these 200 years have also seen the Romantic movement, the Napoleonic Wars, the Industrial Revolution, the great intellectual problems of the 19th century, and the dictatorships, world wars, and social changes of the 20th. Plenty to think about. To help you tackle it, I'm going to suggest 10 headings which should bring into focus much else, including art, politics, and sociology. First, why start in 1800? The answer is that by the Catholic Relief Act of 1791, Catholic chapels at last became legal. Within the next two or three years, the English colleges and religious communities established on the continent since the 16th century were driven back to England by the French Revolution. With them came several thousand French clergy, some of whom stayed in England for the rest of their lives. There was much sympathy for them, and their presence helped to break down prejudice against Catholics in England. By the Emancipation Act of 1829, Catholics recovered most of the civil rights enjoyed by others, though at first they were slow to exercise them. Nicholas Wiseman, who was later the first Archbishop of Westminster, commented that their shackles had been removed, but not the numbness and cramp which they had produced. Second, the Act of 1791 encouraged a move from chapels in country houses, supported by aristocratic or gentry patrons, to chapels in towns, supported by the offerings of their congregations. This shift mirrored the changes which were taking place in society at large. Because of the Industrial Revolution, the landed interest was having to share power with the commercial and trading interest, and so we have the Reform Bill of 1832 and the repeal of the Corn Laws in 1846. During the 18th century, the Catholic bishops of the Midlands had lived in the country, but in 1804, Bishop John Milner, who was the son of a tailor, moved to a Georgian mass house in the middle of Wolverhampton. He saw that the future would be in the towns. Third, the churches which were built in consequence of this migration. They were mostly Gothic, thanks to the fanatical genius of Augustus Pugin, 1812-52, who regarded classical architecture, including St. Peter's in Rome, as mere paganism. Within 15 years, he succeeded in imposing his views on the country at large, not only by his cathedrals and churches, but also because he was responsible for all the detail, inside and out, of the Houses of Parliament, which had been burnt down in 1834 and were then being rebuilt. Artists are often inspired by past achievement, but for Pugin, this was a crusade to turn the clock back to the 13th century. For some of his admirers, it was a campaign to stop the world, I want to get off. It expressed a distaste for the commercial, industrial, and increasingly democratic world of the Victorian age, and a romantic yearning for an age of aristocratic chivalry. To appreciate this clash, you should visit some of Pugin's buildings and also read some of Tennyson's Idylls of the King and study some of the engineering works of Brunel. Fourth, the makeup of the Catholic community. During the 1840s, a heyday of Pugin, it was joined by former Tractarians from the Church of England, including the future cardinals Newman and Manning, and also by hundreds of thousands of desperately poor Irish refugees from the potato famine, for whom clergy had somehow to provide churches and schools in the appalling slums of the Industrial Revolution. To cope with the growth, the existing four vicars apostolic, missionary bishops, were increased to eight in 1840, and in 1850 they were replaced by a normal hierarchy of 12 bishops headed by Wiseman as Cardinal Archbishop of Westminster. But the mix of old Catholics, former Tractarians and Irish was often uneasy, and there were tensions among the bishops themselves. Several of them had been students in Rome under Wiseman, who sometimes forgot that they were now his colleagues. In 1852, Newman preached a famous sermon on the second spring, in which he rightly said that it might be an English spring with sudden squalls and showers. Fifth, Ultramontanism. After the Revolution and the bullying of Pius VI and Pius VII, the papacy distrusted and disliked anything that smacked of democracy, liberalism, or progress. There was a move towards greater control of the church from Rome, while at the same time the temporal power of the popes over the papal state was under threat from the newly united Kingdom of Italy. In 1870, the First Vatican Council defined that in certain circumstances, the Pope could define points of Christian teaching without the assistance of a general council. But soon afterwards, Italian troops took Rome, and Pope Pius IX became the prisoner of the Vatican. The definition of 1870 owed much to Manning, who had succeeded Wiseman at Westminster in 1865 and was even spoken of as a possible successor to Pius IX, a remarkable prospect for a former Anglican archdeacon. Sixth, there were the problems for traditional interpretations of the Bible, which were posed by evolution, geology, archaeology, linguistics, and philosophy. The importance of Newman here is that he was the first great theologian to grapple with history as the record of change. History itself only became a university subject in the 19th century, and many Christians followed St. Augustine in holding that change, and so history, was a consequence of original sin. To understand these issues, you should try to read at least part of three of Newman's books: The Essay on Development, 1845, The Apologia pro Vita Sua, 1864, and The Grammar of Assent, 1870. Seventh, these issues are often summed up in terms of a contrast between the three cardinals, Wiseman, Manning, and Newman. This is a handy and useful approach, but you should avoid typecasting. Wiseman was better as a scholar and preacher than as an ecclesiastical administrator. Newman was not only the reserved scholar, he also had poor parishes to run, both as an Anglican and as a Catholic. Manning was an ecclesiastical statesman and social reformer who sat on royal commissions and mediated in the London dock strike of 1889. He was also a member of the Metaphysical Society in London, which brought together leading scientists, writers, and philosophers. Nor should you forget the fourth Victorian cardinal, Herbert Vaughan, Manning's successor at Westminster. His 11 years there included the Diamond Jubilee of Queen Victoria in 1897 and the coronation of Edward VII in 1902. Like Manning, he was concerned with pastoral issues, schools, orphanages, campaigns for temperance and slum demolition, but in 1866 he founded the Mill Hill Missionaries for work in the expanding British Empire, and his great monument is Westminster Cathedral, which was opened just in time for his own funeral. Eighth, there were the consequences of the First World War, 1914-18. The shared experience of the trenches did much to break down lingering prejudices. Afterwards, there was a huge development of suburban housing estates and of new parishes to serve them. These had a different social structure and atmosphere from the inner city parishes out of which many families had moved. Many of the suburban churches were in some form of Romanesque, which gave a better view than the Victorian Gothic of the inner city parishes. At this time, there was also a remarkable crop of Catholic writers, including Hilaire Belloc, G.K. Chesterton, Monsignor Ronald Knox, and Evelyn Waugh. But the rise of the dictators in the 1920s and 1930s exposed another fault line. Belloc was an outspoken admirer of Mussolini, and nearly all Catholics supported General Franco in the Spanish Civil War and Dr. Salazar in Portugal, if the alternative was communism. Ninth, there were the consequences of the Second World War, 1939-45. This brought an influx of Poles, Free French and Americans on the one side, and of Catholic Italian and German prisoners on the other. Some of these, like the French clergy 150 years before, decided to stay here, particularly after the Russian takeover of Eastern Europe, which lasted from 1945 to 1989. The Education Act of 1944 made it possible for far more Catholics to go on to university, but the raising of money for schools under the Act dominated pastoral strategy for 30 years, and theological ideas current on the continent were still unfamiliar in Britain when the Second Vatican Council opened in 1962. And tenth, there is the Second Vatican Council itself. This is best known for extending the use of local languages in worship, but this was only part of a much wider program of renewal, reform, and adaptation. Of its 16 documents, the most important are those on the Church, which has been set as a required text for A-level, on Revelation, on the Liturgy, and on the Church in the modern world. It has often been described as Newman's Council, and all the popes for the last 50 years have been great admirers of Newman. But the squalls and showers continue. The council went too far for some, and not far enough for others. On the debit side, there was a huge decline in vocations to the priesthood and the religious life. On the credit side, a much deeper appreciation of the Bible and the liturgy, and a much warmer understanding of other Christian traditions. There is unfinished business here, which needs to be carried forward by those of you who are now doing A-levels.